this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is one of the best-known broadcast journalists working in the British media. Her work includes interviewing some of the world's most notable personalities and politicians on BBC Hard Talk and hosting Global Questions on BBC World TV and the BBC News Channel. She's also the founder of the production company Cush Communications, which creates thought-provoking programmes and films, including the groundbreaking 20-part series The History of Africa. She's been chair of the Royal African Society and is the current president of SOAS, University of London. Her new book is An African History of Africa. Zeynep Badawi, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hello, Georgina. Great to be with you. Thank you.
This book is absolutely fascinating. It's a history of Africa told by Africans. And I want to start with your own history, your own family history, because you were born in Khartoum. Tell us about your background and perhaps going back a couple of generations, because fascinating ancestry.
Yes. So, yes, indeed, I was born in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, and I have actually lived in the UK, however, since I was 2 years of age, going on three. So I consider myself a Sudanese Brit or British Sudanese, whichever way you want to look at it. And although I did move here as an infant, my family have always maintained very close ties with the Sudan. And of course, it's with great, great sadness and grief that we all observe what's going on now with this conflict that's raged for a year. And my family originally came from northern Sudan, but have lived in the capital, Khartoum, for two or three generations now. And we say in the family that education for girls is the family business, because my great-grandfather was the pioneer of women's education in the Sudan. So at the turn of the last century, in the 20th century, he thought to himself, why is it only my sons who have the opportunity to go to school and not my daughters? And so he set up in the courtyard of his own home a school where he put his girls there and also invited girls from the neighbourhood to have lessons. And if you imagine, the illiteracy rate for females in Sudan at that time would have been pretty much close to 100%. So, you know, he was vilified by the local community. How dare you do this? And the British authorities who were in Sudan at the time said to him, look, you must desist from this. It's going to bring you trouble. But he persisted. And indeed, we established schools for girls in Sudan. And also the family in the 60s established a university for women in the capital, which still exists and attracts girls from all over Sudan, as well as all over Africa, and even from parts of the Arab world and India. So education is the family business. And it means that although I come from a Muslim background, the idea that Islam is somehow inimical to girls' education, as we've seen with the example of Malala Yousafzai in Pakistan and parts of Afghanistan, has always been inimical to me, because I grew up with aunts, great aunts, grandmothers who were all highly educated, some aunts with PhDs from Western universities. So I've never really accepted this idea that's very prevalent, that women of a Muslim background should not also be highly educated. So I'm very fortunate to come from such a liberal family.
Where does that belief come from, and why is it widely held, though?
I mean, I don't know where it... I mean, I suppose the thing about Islam is that it embeds itself very much in the culture of wherever it's gone. And so if in Afghanistan, it would have found traditions which said that women should stay at home and not go to school. Because if you speak to a lot of Muslim scholars, they will say to you that, for example, Khadija, the first wife of the Prophet Muhammad, who was some 20 years his senior, was an educated woman, was a businesswoman. In fact, he worked for her, I believe. So she clearly was an independent woman of means and was his first convert to Islam. So there is a very strong precedent from the Prophet's own personal life, which strongly indicates that women can be a business person and so on. And so I suppose it depends on the school of thought that you come from in Islam.
And we'll get into that because, of course, your book fascinatingly traces the history of various sort of monotheistic religions and where they fit in geographically and how they interweave with each other. You're not the first journalist in your family either.
No, my father, my late wonderful father, was involved in pre-independence politics in the Sudan. But when Sudan got its independence in 1956, he went into journalism in Sudan and working in a newspaper, became an editor of a newspaper, writing in Arabic. And then when the military dictatorship, first one, came in 1958, press freedoms were gradually stripped away in the country. So by the 60s, he really couldn't operate in the country anymore. So he went to England and worked with the BBC Arabic service. And I suppose somewhere at the back of my mind, it must have been something that must have appealed to me. And yes, here I was following in my father's footsteps by going into the world of journalism. But it was never really a kind of overt link I made with what my father did and me. And of course, he worked always in Arabic and wrote in Arabic beautifully and wrote books as well. But I suppose I must have that same sense of curiosity that he had and a belief in the power of the pen.
Mm. After PPE at Oxford, that was when you started your media career. How did it begin for you?
I always wanted to be a doctor from the age of 3 to 16. And so it was only when I realised I was much better at the art subjects than the sciences that I abandoned that ambition and didn't do sciences at A level, and then indeed went to Oxford to study philosophy, politics and economics, but still not really knowing what I wanted to do. But I did join the Oxford University Broadcasting Society while I was an undergraduate there. And when I left, I actually did further studies for a year after I left Oxford. And it was only then that I thought, hey, why don't I try my hand at television? And so I applied for a graduate trainee programme with ITV, and I got that, and I just kind of walked into television and stayed in it ever since.
Absolutely, and getting more and more prominent throughout the years. I mean, 3 decades you've been in media here.
Oh, I hate to say, Georgina, it's actually more like 4 decades. I started very early, says hastily.
Clearly a child worker. We need to speak to the BBC about their policies on that. But every time you've sort of moved up a grade, if you like, the people that you interview, of course, get more and more powerful. And I wonder what your experience of, or your approach to interviewing powerful or influential and sometimes quite controversial figures, often men, from across the world has been as a female interviewer.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. I think there is a tendency sometimes for male interviewees to slightly try to intimidate you as a female interviewer. And I think that's something that's held me in good stead, which is I am not easily intimidated, if at all. So they might try and throw you by saying to you, I think that what you've just said there is wrong. And so I've really got to defend my patch and really just hold my nerve and insist quietly on why what I've said is backed by X, Y, Z. So I think it is true that having interviewed lots of people in positions of power, that the vast majority would be men, and that does tell you something about our world. Although, wherever possible, we always try to speak to women of influence. But, I mean, some people who are in positions of power are very, very impressive. Others, you can tell, are just there by accident. But it has been very, very interesting and fascinating to engage, particularly on a programme such as Hard Talk, with somebody in a position of power and really drill down over 24 minutes or so, which, as you know, Georgina, is very long in broadcast. And it means that you have more than just a superficial grasp of what they are. It's a very good way of assessing somebody when they sit across the table from you. And although they know more about the topic that you're interviewing them about, I am the TV professional and I am comfortable in the studio. So if they do try to intimidate me, the studio is my friend with all those cameras whizzing around, and that intimidates them.
I mean, you've been such a role model for women journalists in particular. You had four kids along the way, and somehow that hasn't slowed you down, which I find absolutely admirable.
That's very kind of you to say that I've been a role model. If I have managed to inspire any young women in whatever career they choose, then I'm very flattered and very glad that that has happened. Yes, I have four wonderful children, two sons and two daughters. I adore them, of course, and they are my life. And I don't think they feel shortchanged by me as a parent. When people ask me about women working once they've had children, I do think it depends on the profession so much. And I was very, very lucky that my profession was very flexible and allowed me to work in the studio, so I could have regular hours by presenting live in the studio, and I could be home to see the children every evening. So I didn't travel a lot when they were young. Mm. I travelled more once they grew up.
You're right. I mean, it is one of the easier professions, indeed, to just be able to balance the two of those. Now, they went to British schools. So did you. Hornsey, I believe, a Crouch End girl. Although I was at school in Zimbabwe, the curriculum across the board is pretty much the same. We learn history, but we learn it from a British colonial point of view. And what you have done is completely changed that. For once, and in such a refreshing way, we have these stories from an African perspective. Now, that actually started with the television series that you made. Tell us about that.
Yes, so I made 20 45-minute films looking at the history of Africa, starting from the origins of humankind to the modern era, independence. I don't really look at current Africa in the series. And that occupied me for the best part of 7 years. I travelled to 34 African countries. And that, in a way, really laid the groundwork for my book. And what made me think that I had to write this book was I interviewed dozens and dozens of historians, anthropologists, archaeologists, all African across the continent. And making the TV programmes, I could only extract short parts of what they actually told me. And I had so much good material left in those interviews that I couldn't do justice to. And that made me think, I really should try to incorporate some of that information, or at least their vision and perspective on that particular aspect of African history somehow. And the other reason that made me think that I needed to write this book was, to a man and woman, every time I went to interview an African academic, or sometimes it would be an informed citizen, I often would arrive late because African traffic can be awful, but they were all so welcoming and polite and patient and said, doesn't matter that you're late. And I would literally have to tear myself away from them because they were just so happy that somebody at last was listening to them, you know, with the cameras rolling. They recognised me from the BBC. They were delighted that this programme was going to go out on the BBC telling their history. And I really felt duty-bound to see myself as an intercessor between them and the viewer or the reader, and bringing their occluded history and perspective of Africa to a wider audience. I felt, look, this is within my power to do this. It would be negligent of me if I didn't do that. So it really was a mission for me. And I hope I've done all those wonderful intellectuals in Africa whom I encountered justice. I don't feel that I have managed to obviously do everything I would have liked to, because, you know, because of reasons of time and so on, and the book can't go on forever. But I do feel that I have represented the views of African historians and given them the respect that they deserve in making their own history better known to the world.
And just taught the rest of us that actually these people exist, because we hardly ever hear from them. And if there is an opinion, it is generally going to be from a Western perspective. And finding all these intellectuals who are still within the country, in itself pretty challenging. I mean, when you look at, say, for instance, somewhere like Sudan, or indeed even Zimbabwe, where you're looking at intellectual flight, that's quite surprising.
Absolutely. I mean, I tried to make sure that my sources were predominantly African, and you talk about intellectual flight, but a few of the academics I interviewed, or obviously I had to do more extensive research than just my interviews, some of the African sources that I used were from African academics working in Western institutions. And actually, a lot of the academics I interviewed who were in Africa all had PhDs from, you know, Cambridge, the Sorbonne in France, or Bonn in Germany, whatever. They were all, you know, they would be very much at home in the senior common room of any leading university. But you get it, Georgina, that this African perspective is important because you are from Zimbabwe. But if there's any French listener listening to this, I don't wish to embarrass the French because I adore France and the French. But the book has been translated into 9 languages. You know, Portuguese, Italian, Dutch, German. And the French have said, well, we don't know about this book because it doesn't really bring Africa's history from a French perspective. And I said to my publishers and my agent, but that's the whole point of the book. It's not bringing any European perspective. It's bringing an African perspective. But that does really show you the climate in which we still operate, that a leading European country, which has been one of the 2 major colonial powers in 2024, is still saying we need a book about Africa written by a French author bringing the French perspective.
I mean, you make
the
point.
I find that so surprising.
It's extraordinary. You make the point at the beginning of the book that you start with the origins of humankind, how human societies and culture developed, and that we all come from the same root.
Absolutely. I mean, you and your wonderful blonde hair and blue-grey eyes and so on, you know, everybody comes from Africa, regardless of what they look like. And I was keen, I wondered about whether I should start the book looking at the origins of humankind. And then I thought, you know what, I will actually, because nobody on earth cannot say that Mother Africa is not their home continent, whether you're blue-eyed, flaxen-haired or whatever. And so I wanted to just start there to say, look, this is the history of the continent of your birth. You may not see it that way in the modern era, but if you are not African or of African descent, you might think, oh, this is a foreign history. But I wanted to be more inclusive and to say, you know what, you should know about history.
Now, one bit of the history that we all think we know is ancient Egypt. And you start with that and you tell us a great deal that, in fact, is not widely known. And again, from the perspective of Egyptian historians, you then go on to the histories of Sudan, Ethiopia and Eritrea. And of course, that's completely fascinating because it's your own background and you're weaving your own stories into that. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes people say to me, oh, what's the favourite part of the book? I suppose I could say, and I may be forgiven for my prejudice, is that the chapter on ancient Sudan, I did find the most fascinating, simply because people think history is something you can consign to the past, but it awakened in me memories of seeing certain things in my grandmother's home, which I subsequently found had existed from the time of the ancient Sudanese. And you're going back many hundreds of years BCE, before Common Era. So I liked the fact that the chapter on Sudan did link my past with my present. And the part of ancient Sudan that I focus on the most is on the kings of Kush, who governed Egypt for the best part of a century between the 700s and the 800s. And often this is overlooked, the fact that they formed Egypt's 25th dynasty. They are sometimes referred to erroneously as the Nubian dynasty, including by Egyptians today. But that serves to really de-emphasize the fact that they were from Sudan. They were never part of territorial Egypt. And if you say Nubian, there are Nubians in both Egypt and Sudan, and that may be misleading. People might think, it's when the Egyptians were governed by their southern Nubians, but these were Sudanese. And it's a marvellous history. One of the kings is mentioned in the Bible. Again, he's mentioned as king of Ethiopia, which is not modern day Ethiopia, but it just means land of the blacks. And that was how Sudan then was referred to. The chapter on Ethiopia too, yes, I have a great-grandmother who was Ethiopian. So again, another African country with which I can claim roots, which again has a marvellous history. You know, it had a written language from the 3rd century, Common Era, and recorded its history in a wonderful book called The Glory of the Kings, which is the Kebra Nagast in Amharic, which looks at the Solomonic dynasty, which ended with Haile Selassie. So such a rich history that I explore.
No, absolutely. You then go on to North Africa, and this is where we come back to religion, because you talk about what a strong impact that region had on the three major monotheistic religions of the time. Just give us a very brief overview of that. I'm so sorry that I'm rushing you through this huge continent and this vast amount of years. Give me the history of Africa in 7.5 minutes.
Yeah, a quick canter through Africa's history. Yes, I mean, North Africa really had a long-standing Jewish community. People know about the story of Moses in Egypt and so on, and how the Jewish community of North Africa existed in substantial numbers right until the middle of the 20th century, when a lot of them left and went to Israel or European countries. It also was, of course, the Arabs conquered Egypt in the early 640s and brought Islam to North Africa, and it kind of proliferated throughout northern Africa as well as into the west of the continent. And Christianity, of course, before that. St. Augustine was somebody who's born in modern-day Algeria. He's a key Christian thinker who was African. He had a Berber heritage. And I say how I visited the marvellous cathedral, the St. Augustine Church in Algeria, which was, at the time of my visit, was presided over by a Congolese cleric. So, you know, one of Christianity's foremost thinkers, his legacy being guarded in a most magnificent way in the heart of a Muslim country such as Algeria. So, yes, North Africa was very, very significant in the early Judaism, Christianity and Islam.
And it seemed that there was a great deal of respect for each religion from each other religion, that there was none of this, these huge divisions that we see this day. Similarly, you talk about the kingdoms of West Africa. Now, of course, now we think of that region and we think of conflict. We think of the, what is it, 7 or 9 coups that have taken place there in this short period of time. But of course, these were massive, very powerful kingdoms.
Oh, wonderful. I mean, the first significant kingdom in West Africa, that of Ghana, after which Kwame Nkrumah named his newly independent country in 1957 Ghana, although confusingly there was no geographic overlap between modern-day Ghana and the Empire of Ghana. The best known, perhaps, the Empire of Mali, which produced the wonderful king Mansa Musa, who in the late 13th century carried out his amazing historic pilgrimage to Mecca, and super, super rich part of the world because he had so much gold. When he spent so lavishly in Cairo, the price of gold plunged for 7 years. And then also the Songhai Empire, where the great city, legendary city of Timbuktu, really enjoyed its heyday. And it was a real repository of knowledge and learning, the great library in the great mosque in Timbuktu, where you have an amazing African literature, astronomy, science, mathematics, African literature, African knowledge and thought written in the Arabic language, but nevertheless African, with great thinkers like Ahmed Baba in the 1500s, who wrote a treatise against slavery and so on. So this idea that Africa existed on the edge of history is really not borne out by these kingdoms. And, you know, this idea that there are those who make history and those who stay outside of history, Africa being the one that's on the edge, is just not borne out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in this conversation, we've given listeners enough of a snapshot of how deeply interesting this is, without ever going into, for instance, the slave trade, both the slave trade driven from the Indian Ocean and people within, and the transatlantic slave trade. The southern kingdoms, obviously, I read those chapters with huge attention, talking to us about Great Zimbabwe, also the Asante people. And then, of course, you go on to the European invasions and the tremendous resistance shown. You end the book talking about the future of the continent. And as we know, Africa really is a very youthful continent, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the average age in Africa is about 18 or 19. If you think of a country like Japan, it's 49. The UK is early, mid-40s. You know, it is a young continent. And wherever you have young people, everybody knows that from their own young relatives or children, you have a vibrancy, you have an entrepreneurship, you have a quest for knowledge, a thirst for ambition. And so I cannot see how this continent can be consigned either to the dustbin of history or the dustbin of the present or the future when it's got this amazing demographic boon. And so I do end by saying that I think that, of course, there are myriad challenges for Africa at the moment. But I think, you know, in 20 years' time, perhaps if I were to stick my neck out and give it a time frame, I think there'll be a very significant transformation. We're already seeing that taking place. And I think that is largely because of the youth and vigour of the continent.
And if we want to be involved in that, if we want to engage with it, if we want to benefit from it, we really need to understand the history, and we need to understand the history from within the continent. And that is the very precious gift that you've given
us. You're absolutely right, Georgie. And you can't jump on the train journey when it's practically at the end. You've got to start it at the beginning.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I'm hooking my wagon to yours and coming on that journey. Zainab, many thanks.
Thank you very much, Georgina. Thank you for your time.
An African History of Africa, From the Dawn of Humanity to Independence by Zainab Badawi, published by Ibury. It's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the producer, Tamsin Howard. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.